Winter booked the salt and vinegar on literature's fish and chips. Who'd like a battered sausage? This is my poem about the fact that I'm not really a D.H. Lawrence fan, but it's also about fish and chips. Salt makes D.H. Lawrence's novels salty. Vinegar makes them tangy, understood? Batter makes them crunchy. Frying makes them munchy, but nothing makes them any bloody good. So, who's dipping their haddock in the hot pot today? Mark Thomas and Roger McGough. And would you like them wrapped up or open? Dilly Keane and Miles Kington. Well, now we've got our little wooden forks and warm cans of pot, let's squirt some sauce. In our first round, the panellists have a pile of cards in front of them. One member gives clues to the other member as to the title of the book, and the other member has to guess it. You've only got a minute, and I'm going to be strictness itself, and we're looking for books with numbers in the title. So, Roger and Mark, off you go with your numbered books.
James Bond...
007.
No, more than that, no. About Living.
Living?
About Living, yes. Title of a Bond film.
Live and Let Die, Thunderbolt,
Once Upon a Time.
Two, you only
yes,
twice.
Yes.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, this is a good one. This was Lover of Sartre, and Sartre's Lover, French woman.
Simone Signore.
Simone de Beauvoir. De Beauvoir. But nice.
Oh, sorry! Sorry, there is literary Lover.
Yeah,
yes.
And
Simone de Beauvoir.
And she wrote...
Oh, God, yeah.
She wrote a book.
30 Sex seconds. Single Woman. Second Sex. Thanks a lot. Oh, yeah, these are James Buchan novel.
I'm not going to get that.
Yes, you are.
No, I'm not.
Going up the
39
road.
Steps.
Right, thank you.
This is a film with... Oh, this is brilliant, because this is what we are in.
15 seconds.
And it was a film with Alan Arkin.
You're Syrian!
And,
yes,
you know the book.
Yes, I do know the book.
Hella.
I know, Catch 22. And this is about the jury. The jury, great film, great
12
movie.
12 Angry Men.
Exactly.
This is
that's the end.
This is, no.
Go on.
No, I'm in it. Can I
all right, go on.
They're out camping. They're out camping.
Five go camping.
Yeah, famous five. There you go.
There you go. Yeah.
Right, Dillian Miles, off you go. And I'm really strict.
Shakespeare play.
Last night.
No, just two lads in an Italian town.
Two Gentlemen of Rome.
You said two there, Miles.
Yes.
Not allowed to do that.
Written by T.E. Lawrence and
Seven Pillars of Wisdom.
Yes.
Jerome K. Jerome. There was a dog as well, but...
Three Men in a Boat. And All for One and One for All.
Three Musketeers.
Yep.
Ah, Shakespeare. It was, I think, what you said before. It was not...
Twas Night.
Oh.
These small animals
seconds.
honkingly, went to market.
Five little pigs.
Count my fingers.
Three little pigs.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh God, it's a great film, the Kubrick film. They went off on a great spaceship.
2001.
Yep.
Yeah. And this is of Orwell, and it's scary.
1984.
Yeah.
I don't know this one.
It's the last one.
And this is not the first, not the second.
Time's up.
Third. The person. Yes.
Man.
Yes.
All right, then. Beginnings and endings. In this round, our panellists have to use their wit and knowledge to rewrite classic works of literature. So, Mark.
Yes.
What have you done for us today?
Well, what I've done is Steinbeck, The Grapes of Wrath, and which is, I think, one of the best books ever written. It's a fantastic book. And if you remember, it's the journey of migrant workers across America and the fight that they have to basically get decent living conditions, blah, 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 blah. And I've kind of changed this, and I've brought it over to Britain. And I thought, because Steinbeck wrote about the working class, I thought it's time that really we gave the upper class a look in and had a look at the upper class struggles through Steinbeck. From all across the country, they came, filling the highways like ants, chasing a better life. Hounded by traffic cops who regarded them like dirt, mindless hours on that road with lorries forcing the wet tarmac to spray its engulfing visionless cloud over panicked drivers lost but determined to reach their destination. They were ordinary, working, managing directors. Members of the CBI and right-wing think tanks heading west, northwest to Blackpool for the Labour Party conference. It was the last chance to save their lives. All of them held a handbill. A simple handbill given them by a union man with the words, wanted a decent wage, fight for a minimum wage, £4.42 an hour. To pay £4.42 an hour, many of them faced certain second homelessness. These were tough, hard men. They were managing directors of industry. They knew about hard work. They had got rich through hard work. Not their own, obviously. But they had watched other people work hard. £4.42 an hour, a minimum wage. They were not chasing a dream. They were chasing a nightmare. £4.42 an hour. They were heading northwest, armed only with reason, humanity, a handful of lobbyists and some brown paper envelopes given to them by a friendly Arab grocer. They had travelled across the land, filling the highways with their old family limousines, heading down the black, shiny, tarmacked arteries of Britain, passing relics of a better age, of an era of hope, seeing those signs, the cones, hotline, billboards. Those were the days. The days when a managing director could sack 1,000 men in the morning, sell his share options, pick up a knighthood in the afternoon, and still have time for perverse public school sexual practices. Those days were past. They were only memories. The memories when boardrooms echoed with the screams of, stick another muffin in me and beat me like the gardener. That's the beginning. Right, this is the ending. It's all got... I don't know if you remember the book. It's a fantastic book, basically, I'm saying. Go and buy it and read it. But it ends up with all sorts of fights between union men and non-union men and trying to fight for a better way. And this is what happens. This is the end of the CBI directors. This is what happens to them. Outside the conference centre, the fat cats gathered. Some of them had been driven into the arms of radical parties and full of new convert zeal were openly selling extremist literature. Capitalist bastard! Capitalist bastard! Fighting to legalise industrial accidents. The crowd swelled and heaved, and the chants went up. The bosses united will never be defeated. The bosses united will never be defeated. A coach of illegal supporters, flying executives, or as they're known, club class, joined the ranks. A cry went up amongst the throng. What do we want?
Everything.
When do we want it?
Backdated for tax purposes.
With the enormous police presence, it escalated inevitably into a riot. At first, it was just a few canapes thrown in anger at the police. Then a laptop caught a cop on the side of the head. He went down, bleeding, and he was viciously attacked by screaming members of the Adam Smith Institute, who beat him and pounded him, the prone man, as he lay there. They beat him with copies rolled up of the Tatler till the blood splattered their grey coats. One businessman shouted, let me through to help them, for God's sake, let me through, that man needs my help, let me through. I'm an arms dealer, for God's sake, let me through. From the side appeared a man known to them all simply as the Crab. Or to give him his full name, Peter Mandelson. He looked at the battered business class and said, really, if you'd wanted to come in, you need only have asked.
So, Miles, what are your new beginnings and endings?
Well, I was invited to deal with... North and South by Mrs. Gaskell, a classic Victorian novel, which I'd never read. And it explains in the Literary Companion that this is a story of a Victorian clergyman who has doubts about his religious faith and moves from the South to the North of England. This is how it starts now. When the Reverend Mr. Hale, that's his name, began to have religious doubts and moved to the North of England, he found it hard to explain to his family the connection between loss of faith and a desire to be closer to the Scottish border.
Father,
said his daughter to him one day,
do you honestly believe that living within easy reach of Manchester will bring you back to God?
He had to admit that it would not.
Is Macclesfield proof of God's ability to perform miracles?
He thought on the whole that it was not. But he also found it hard to explain to his daughter that it was cheaper to live in the north, and that a clergyman who was no longer on everyday speaking terms with God would have to make certain economies. Mr. Hale's life also changed in certain other ways when he moved north. He had held fast to certain other beliefs from his earliest days, such as that there were three persons in the Trinity, four sides to a square, and 15 men to a rugby side. In the north, it was different. They sincerely believed that 13 men was quite enough in a rugby side. Moreover, they ran with the ball more and didn't waste their time in those ridiculous 16-man scrummages as they did down south. Moreover, up in the north of England, they saw nothing wrong with paying a man to play rugby football. This appealed to the Reverend Mr. Hale, especially as he had been a very fine rugby three-quarter at the university and now needed the money badly. Well, that's the beginning. Now we go to the end.
Who's this new fella playing on wing for Wigan?
Said a man in the crowd, trying to peer at his companion's programme.
Fellow of the name of Reverend Mr. Hale,
said the man, reading slowly from the programme page.
Our new close-season acquisition is known as the Flying Father. We'll give our penetrative running play an added boost, and as he is in sacred orders, he'll also be very useful in moments of unholy disagreement.
Here, I think we got one now,
said his friend, pointing to the pitch where the Reverend Mr. Hale had just been felled by a high, stiff-armed tackle. Slowly, painfully, the Flying Father got to his feet and faced his assailant, Big Jim Barley from Bradford.
Didn't get much divine protection there, did you, Father?
Sneered the Yorkshireman. Well, I wasn't expecting any, said the Reverend Mr. Hale. I have already left the church because of my loss of faith. I do not expect to have to leave Rugby League for the same reason. God is not playing for either of our sides, friend. The modest tone of the reply impressed Big Jim Barley so much that when he next gave the courageous clergyman a stiff arm tackle, he tried not to hurt him too much. But what impressed the crowd most was what followed. As Big Jim stood over the stunned cleric again, a flash of light came from the heavens and hit him on the forehead. As the crowd watched breathtaking, they saw Big Jim fall like an ox that had been felled by a blow.
That were a thunderbolt,
said the man in the crowd.
Sent by God.
And so it was. Faced with this incontrovertible proof that God not only existed, but took an active interest in fair play on the field, the Reverend Mr. Hale became one of the most devout players in the Rugby League, and one of the most successful, as thereafter very few opposing players dared put in a full-blooded tackle on him, for fear that they too would suffer retaliation from up high. The Flying Father became the leading try-scorer north of Stafford. So it came as a great shock when he announced that he was moving south again and joining Bath as a full-time player.
Father,
said his daughter,
are we moving back to the south because you have regained your religion again?
No, child, said the Reverend Mr. Hale. He showed her the letter he had received from Bath Football Club, indicating with his finger the vast sum they were now prepared to pay him under the counter. Let us say, rather, that I have wrestled with my soul and that, after a fierce struggle, I have lost my faith in the kind of paltry money that Rugby League is prepared to pay me.
Now we move on to Vox Pops. Authors this time, not books. Authors sketched by the reading public, sometimes vaguely, and sometimes with great, if erroneous, precision. So, Miles and Dilly, try and guess this author.
He was an MP.
Went to sea.
He had a brief spell in prison.
Sailed to Cadiz.
He was a Jesuit.
Became a reformed rake.
He had a secret marriage.
He was always very sensual.
I could never understand what on earth he was going on about.
A very religious man.
He's got very
long, convoluted and
red, thick lips.
Obscure and indecipherable.
The poem I always remember is The Flea. Basically, all he's trying to do is get his mistress into bed with him.
So,
prison.
Jesuit.
Hurt. Jesuit.
Cadiz.
I was going to say John Donne, but he wasn't a Jesuit, was he? Hopkins, he never went to jail.
Don't forget that the public don't always get it right.
And nor do we, Ian. was he English, or was it foreign?
English.
And The Flea's the big giveaway here.
I think you've said it once, Miles, but yes. Then you contradicted yourself. John Donne.
Really?
Aye. Was he a Jesuit, then?
No.
I don't think he was. Roger Matt, see if you can get this Jesuit.
She was born in Torquay.
She never went to school.
Worked as a nurse during the First World War.
Had a poem published when she was 11.
Absolutely prolific.
Formulaic novels.
Insightful.
Exotic.
Stories.
Locations.
Interested in Egyptology.
Rather looked down on by the literary establishment.
This is rubbish, really. It's not deep, and yet you can't put it down.
Was unable to take the fame and vanished.
Sometimes accused of racism.
She spent some time in Harrogate, didn't she?
She did.
With Dustin Hoffman
mm-hmm.
in the film. And sailed down the Nile with Poirot.
Yeah, that's right.
Inspector Poirot. And it was Agatha Christie.
They said as one. And now, conversation consequences. Improbable characters of literature meet and converse. Dilly.
Well, I have those four great literary titans, Mary Cotter, Mary Radley, Mary Simpson, Mary Field, i.e. the four Marys, known to great readers of Bunty. And the four Marys have been stalwarts of Bunty for the last 30 years anyway. And they meet Harvey, the rabbit, in the play of that name. It's got a complicated cast list. Mary Cotter is being played by Miles, Mary Radley is being played by Mark. I'm playing Mary Simpson. Mary Field is Roger, and Harvey is Ian. Is it the start of term?
I say, Mary!
Mary, so good to see you again. And there's Mary.
Hi, Mary. Hi, Mary. Ripping to be back. Look, there's Mary.
Hello, Mary. Hello, Mary. Hello, Mary.
Isn't it super that term is beginning again, Mary?
Yes, I do miss school during the holes, don't you, Mary?
Yes. Nothing's quite as spiffing as dear old St. Lemmings, Mary.
Gosh, I rather like being home during the holes, Mary.
Weird, Mary.
I know. Let's swear our friendship in blood like we usually do, Mary.
Here's my Swiss Army knife, Mary.
All got hankies to staunch the flow after the ritual, Mary.
Do we have to do this?
Don't be a drip, Mary.
Right, Mary, join hands before the blood starts clotting.
Mary, don't forget to roll down your right sock.
And hoist up your school penny, Mary.
Mary, swear before the pentangle.
I swear to be a complete Mary all my days and only to ever help other people called Mary.
I swear.
Good. Now, what about the holes? Do anything exciting, Mary?
Oh, nothing much, Mary. I found some buried treasure beneath the flagstones of an old ruined temple just near where my grandparents live.
What kind of treasure, Mary?
Oh, the usual. Yards of pearls, jewel-encrusted golden goblets, cask of doubloons. What about you, Mary?
Pretty boring, Mary. Spent most of the vac foiling some Bolshie plotters who rented the old house next door and were planning to bring down the government, Mary.
How did you capture them, Mary?
I spread some cod liver oil on the floor near the old trapdoor, Mary, which was rotting. When they came in with their guns, they slipped on the oil, the trapdoor gave way, their guns went off and they're all wounded and I called the police. How about you, Mary?
Very quiet, Mary. My brother broke his arm rescuing an old lady's tabby from the path of a speeding car. So although I had whooping cough, I had to pretend I was him and take his place as tight head prop in the village rugger team for the honour of the village.
How did it go, Mary?
17 unbeaten matches and we won the county cup again. So what did you do, Mary?
I made a new friend.
A new friend, Mary?
How contrary, Mary.
What's her name, Mary?
Susan.
Traitor! Quisling!
You know we only have ever friends called Mary.
It's our pact and we shouldn't vary, Mary.
This is scary, Mary.
You should be more cheery, Mary.
So what else did you do in the holes, Mary?
Anything we might be interested in, Mary?
Surely you must have at least foiled some bank robbers, Mary.
I got a rabbit.
A rabbit, Mary?
Yes, a pet rabbit.
A pet rabbit, Mary?
Yes, his name's Harvey.
That's a stupid name, Mary.
What do you mean, Harvey's a stupid name?
Oh! Who said that?
I did.
Who's there?
It's me, Harvey.
But where are you?
I'm right in front of you here.
Where?
Here with Mary Field.
But we can't see you anywhere.
That's because I'm invisible.
Crikey, an invisible rabbit.
Exactly.
Oh, come on, you Marys. There's no need to be frightened. Even if Harvey is invisible, he's only a rabbit.
Only a rabbit, eh? What would you say if I were to tell you I'm a 6-foot rabbit?
6 foot? My word, that's pretty big.
And you know the reputation we book rabbits have.
You don't mean you and Mary Field?
You bet your sweet bippy I do. Mary Field and I had a very exciting holiday indeed. Come on, Mary, let's go back to the Warren.
Oh, Harvey.
Mary, that's not my paw.
Roger, what are your
Yes, I was given Snow White meets Fungus the Bogeyman, you know, Raymond Briggs, in a laundrette. And I'm Snow White, and Mark's got all the best lines with Fungus.
Chew! Bless you.
Thank you.
Chew! Bless you.
Thank you. Is the seat next to you free?
Yes. All the seats next to me are free.
I noticed that. Chew!
Bless you.
Thank you. Is it because you're so ugly and dripping with green slime?
No, it's mainly because I stink.
Oh, I see. I can't smell a thing, you see. Damn cold.
You poor thing. Here, have a tissue.
Thank you. Oh, on second thoughts, I prefer my tissues clean and preferably unused.
It's only got a few bogies on it.
No, really. Call me old-fashioned if you will, but I'm a stickler for cleanliness. In fact, I'm Snow White.
And I'm Vomit Green.
No, I mean, my name's Snow White.
Oh, pardonnez-moi. Snow White? Aren't you the maiden who is shacked up with seven dwarves?
That's right, yes, and that's why I've got seven machines all going full belt.
Snow White?
Yes?
Can I have the dirty water when you've finished, please?
The dirty water?
Yes, because mildew, that's my grungy and monstrously ugly wife.
Oh, she sounds repellent.
Oh, she's worse than that. But of course, ugliness is only skin deep. It's the dark, abysmal caverns of her mind that nourish me.
A marriage made in heaven.
Truly, but I digress. Mildew likes me to come down here to the laundrette at the end of each day and collect a few buckets of bilge from the machines. Bless you. Here. Wipe your dripping nose on my sleeve.
Oh, I'd rather not. It's too dirty.
Nonsense. It's only a bit of snot. You were saying?
What about?
About the wicked queen.
Oh, yes. Well, she's jealous of my beauty, you see, and will not rest until I've popped my clogs.
Oh, dearie me. Then how about your micro mates? Grumpy, bashful, sneezy, dopey, beaky, Mick and Titch. Won't they protect you?
Mates? Ha! Those sexist mini-macho men. Don't make me laugh. Before I arrived, they paid peanuts to Filipino girls. I'm just their skivvy.
Oh, you poor thing. Now, how can I cheer you up? How about a nice red apple?
An apple? How lovely. But wait. I thought the Bogomen hated things that were clean and sweet.
We make an exception in regard to apples.
Oh, I see. This is delicious.
And in regard to sweet, young, virginal princesses like yourself.
Wait, what's happening to me? There are little bumps growing on my head. I'm sprouting hair. My flesh is turning green and slimy and... Oh, the stink!
Yes, the stink.
The stink!
Welcome to Bogeyland, sucker.
And now, follow me to the edge of sanity and into the Black Bag! In this round, the panellists put their hands in a bag and broddle about. The objects in the bag will give them clues to the name of a book or a play. We'll start with Dilly. Dilly, lift up the black bag and place your hand within.
And broddle?
Yes, please.
What's that?
It's a northern term.
Oh. Ooh, it feels like, is it a school cap, maybe?
You are allowed to put two hands in the bag.
Oh, am I? Golly. And then there's some straw.
Yes.
Straw and a school cap.
Yes.
And a letter.
And a letter.
Putting those three together, it's clear.
Someone in the audience said just William, but they were wrong, actually. Straw's the clue.
No.
Straw.
It's not Jennings, either.
It was made into a film with Alan Bates in it. But then what wasn't?
Oh. Far from the Madding Crowd.
No. Go-between.
Yes, of course.
The go-between.
Wow.
Go-between.
What's the straw got to do with that?
In the barn. They're in the barn.
In the barn.
They
doing
spend a lot of time in the barn.
In the barn.
Grundling in the barn.
Grundling, yes.
Sorry, Mark, place your hand within the black bag.
Okay, there's an army helmet here. There's a bottle. It feels like a medicine bottle of some kind. Oh, it's a miniature. It's a little bit of alcohol, possibly gin by the shape of it, or brandy, or one of the other liqueur family. Oh, there's another one. This is Bell's. And, and there's also a thing which is feels like a tent peg. It's a piece of wood.
Is
the shape important?
No. The texture of the wood's important, of course.
It's dry.
Mm-hmm.
It's dry wood. It's possibly driftwood.
Driftwood?
It's driftwood. It's alcohol. It's First World War helmet. No. It's Second World War helmet. Second World War helmet. Alcohol, driftwood. Whiskey. Yeah, oh, yeah. Whiskey. Of course, it's whiskey galore.
Whiskey galore. Now, Miles... You've got four objects in your black bag.
Sending the hands in now. Oh, female bathing cap.
Yep.
A lot of material. A key and a key ring.
Yep.
And
the material.
kind is it, do you think?
Material, I don't know. Cretonne, calico, muslin.
Oh, it's another hand. Oh, silk. It still is.
Silkish.
Silk. Yeah. Silk.
Silk. A key. And another thing which I can't quite identify, which pulls, it's like a whistle. Ah! My God, it's coming too. It's like a...
Is it like a cigarette holder?
Yes, it's like a cigarette holder. Yes, it ejects. It ejects.
So khaki, silk shirt, swimming cap, cigarette holder. Need I say more?
Of course. Is it a Daphne du Maurier?
No.
No, right, okay.
It's American.
Not from here to eternity.
No.
Is it a Scott
Lady
Fitzgerald?
No. Yes. What? Scott Fitzgerald. Greg Gatsby, the audience got it. There you go. The great... And finally, Roger, who's only got three objects in quite a big bag.
One of them's a duvet.
I think it is, actually. One is a book.
Yep.
A book. Right, notebook.
Notebook.
Notebook. One is... Well, what's this big thing that's taking all the room? Which is some sort of coat. Cagoule.
Cagoule, yeah.
A notebook. And a syringe.
A syringe.
Ow. drug addict, monkey.
And it's a particular kind of coat.
Yes. Unfortunately, you can't see it. And it's quilted. It's a quilted jacket.
There's a gent giving you some...
Train spotting.
Train spotting.
Anorak.
Yeah.
Anorak. Train spotting. That's a good one. Right up to the minutes pretty well, haven't we? Well done.
And now, as we pick our teeth with a single haddock bone and lick the vinegar from our fingers, we ponder a moment on the unlikely things famous characters might think but dare not say. Anybody got any least likely to says?
Well, I've got something for Superman. Superman, I think, is unlikely to say, "No, this is not the RSPCA. This is Superman. I am in a phone box. I'm trying to change, and you've got the wrong number."
I was asked to do one for Barbara the elephant, who's the least likely to say, "Hello." Well, anything really, because being an elephant. although, I suppose, when pressed, he might say, you know, "Come on, mouse, make my day."
He's French. He'd say bonjour.
Oh, bonjour, ça va?
Le
No, oui.
Do we?
Catwoman?
This is Oedipus's related lover. And something she might say, which is, "Iron your own toga, I'm not your bloody mother."
Maria from The Sound of Music. Norfolk's nice.
I've got one more which I'll punt out into the comedy void. This is Vladimir from Waiting for Godot, the Beckett play. "Godot? Godot? I thought we were waiting for Gyro."
Right, it's time to finish now with my final poem on the fish and chip theme, entitled "I Would Still Be Living in a Hovel." I would still be living in a hovel if I hadn't invented the deep-fried novel. Now the chattering classes chatter on how they like their Martin Amis with batter on. Now the bookshop assistant had heard to say, "Are you eating it now or taking it away? Eaten from a paper with peas and chips is the way to force Tolstoy past your lips." So it just remains me to thank Mark Thomas, Roger McGough, Dilly Keen and Miles Kington. Was researched by Felicity Goodall, devised and produced in Bristol by Mark Yobst, and presented by me, Ian McMillan. Goodbye.